You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Tuesday, 13 November, I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, chatting with Alex Dace, the Implats, Northam, Royal Bafokeng, but also Aspen. New stories coming out of there. I want to get Alex's view on Aspen. We're going to be talking in construction industry and how it can benefit South Africa. Some amazing stats coming out of a recent conference. And then talking with Peter van der Ross from Stanlib, emerging markets, not structurally outperforming developed markets as much as the theory goes. The show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Some morning headlines, MoneyWeb, PPC to spend $664 million over 3 years to cut carbon emissions by 10%, aims to be net zero by 2050. It works out to $6.5 billion to get it to zero. That's a giant, giant number. Business Day, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey to step down from Twitter. He, of course, is also still at Square. The CTO will be taking over the position of CEO effective immediately. Morning markets, lots of green. We saw the S&P up 1.3%, NASDAQ up 2.3% last night. In Asia, we got Sydney up almost 1%, Tokyo 0.75% higher. Commodities green overnight, but a little weaker from yesterday morning. Gold, $17.90, Brent, $74.20 a barrel, palladium, $1,800. Rand, $16.12. Top 40 opening call, about 80 points higher. That's a little over 0.1% to the green, as Tencent trades 1.6% down in Hong Kong.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Alex Dace, portfolio manager at Mthombolo Wealth. Alex, appreciate the early morning. The sense came out yesterday morning from Implats. They'd initially made an offer for Royal Bafokeng. That then got snubbed as we saw Northam come in and take a stake at Holdco level. Implats now offering effectively 150 Rand a share. That's some Implats and some cash. Your take on it? I mean, my sense was always that the Implats Royal Bafokeng made more sense than the Northam Royal Bafokeng, if nothing else, just because of geography and location.
Yes, good morning, Simon. Without a doubt, deal makes a lot more sense for Impala as with Northam. So for Impala, obviously the life of mines in the Rustenburg needs to be extended. And if they do add the Royal Bafokeng, it can add about 10 to 15 years. And also there's very high rich Merensky grade there as well, and other type of operational benefits that they can get. So certainly this is much better for them. And this deal has been coming a long time in the making. It's been at least the last decade or two, you know, discussions that the deal needs to happen. And of course, the Impala CEO used to be involved as well at Royal Bafokeng Styldrift. So he knows those mines also intimately very well. Not surprised, necessarily, that those institutional shareholders has voted in favor of them. Mm-hmm. Mostly because some of these shareholders probably also owns Royal Bafokeng shares, Impala shares as well. You know, so they're trying to think from that perspective. Now, what I think Northam is trying to achieve here is, I don't think they've got the balance sheet to want to extend that offer of 180 Rand to all shareholders. So as a result, they're probably content to remain a minority shareholder at this particular stage and then perhaps work themselves to some sort of joint venture going forward, because this is a very, very good asset. And I think they are seeing very good cash flows from it. And if you listen to the interview yesterday from Nico Muller, he did say that he's not frowned upon about potentially working in a joint venture with Northam. So let's see what happens. But certainly very interesting at this moment.
Yeah, as you say, the Northam have got that 30-odd% at Holdco level, so they may end up being that JV there. An announcement out from Aspen yesterday that they're in advanced discussions. There's a press conference this afternoon, so I think we can conclude it. They've currently been doing vaccines under fill and finish, but they're actually talking about doing an entire license agreement where they manufacture the vaccines. Aspen's had a really good run. It's pulled back down to, 224 or so. What's your take on Aspen at the current price levels?
Yeah, so Aspen about 3 years ago obviously had huge problems with debt, and the share price, what really smacked them. But since then, they've done very, very well in selling some assets, as well as producing much better cash flows. So deleveraging has happened as a result as overly de-risk the investment thesis, and that's why the share price has recovered to such an extent. Concerns was always about organic growth potential, because Aspen has always been very acquisitive type of business. And now with the Johnson & Johnson vaccines and so forth, it does give them potential lever for growth. So, I mean, I've seen some research suggesting that they could manufacture in excess of over 600 million doses over the next 3 years. And that will be sufficient to vaccinate, you know, roughly 90% of the African population, et cetera. So this could be very, very material, but it's difficult to quantify what exactly they're going to gain from the potential deals and so forth. So certainly there is some blue sky potential there, but it's quite difficult to say. At this moment, I thought the valuation had run ahead of itself, so I'm not surprised that it has pulled back to about 15 or 20% over the last month or two. A current valuation is probably, you know, at base fair value, I would say, with some optionality, just to look into. I think the risk is that they might do more deals going forward. And if you look at the track record over the last 10 or so years, some of the deals hasn't been that great. So I think that is a bit of a concern. So that's one thing to consider. And something that's bothered us as investors in Aspen is the values of the intangible assets of the balance sheet.
Yeah.
If you look, it's a very high number. It's a indefinite type of assumption. But also, if you look at the assumptions they apply every single year over the last 5 or 6 years, every year it seems like they are reducing it, making it more aggressive, reducing the discount, increasing the potential growth rates and so forth. And that just makes me a bit uncomfortable, you know, that it could be some sort of problems down the line with write-downs and so forth. But other than that, you have to take your head down. It's been a remarkable recovery, and the momentum is with them now. And certainly, shareholders do love to buy Aspen, and whenever there's good news, the share price does rally very hard.
Yeah, and I take your point, particularly around the deals. I think deal making is in Stephen Sard's DNA. It's where Aspen came from, of course. It's what he does perhaps best. Alex Dace, portfolio manager. I'm Thumbo Wealth. Appreciate the early morning.
We all have different investment needs. Some of us want to preserve our money for retirement, and others to create wealth for the next generation. At Stanlib, we have a team of investment specialists that can help you achieve any investment goal. So whether your money is looking for more certainty, more return, or more impact through your investments, we have a solution for your investment needs, no matter the time horizon. Join us over the next few months as we provide insights into the solutions we offer to meet your money needs. To find out more, visit stanlib.com or speak to your financial advisor. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. License number 719.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
Chatting now with Andrew Scudder, RIB CCS CEO. Andrew, appreciate the early morning time. A recent conference sponsored by your group around construction and a bunch coming out of it. The number that really struck me was globally, construction's about 13% of employment. South Africa, it's around 8%. We're losing out on huge opportunity here, not just for spending and infrastructure and GDP, but employment in an economy that desperately needs job creation.
Yeah, morning, Simon. Thanks for having me. And you're absolutely right. I think the construction industry has an enormous role to play in as a flywheel in driving economic recovery and particularly employment. You know, when one starts major construction projects and infrastructure projects, it has a direct driver in terms of employment. And where it really affects employment is in your unskilled and semi-skilled labor market, and construction companies, from my experience, are really good at accelerating training, development of those kind of people, and they're the ones that really need the help in terms of employment. But beyond that, when you start driving major infrastructure programs, you start driving the value chain in terms of manufacturing, supply of services, supply of materials. And that has a compounding effect, of course, on employment down the entire value chain.
One of the other comments made was how a consistent flow of big projects to keep the industry thriving. And Australia seems to manage that very well. We seem to have not had any, really, since we've got the power stations, but let's park them aside. I mean, 2010, I mean, we had some public-private partnerships. Is that what we should be sort of going for? I mean, we did the Gautrain. We've done some of the major roads. it works, and those give us those big projects to keep the industry sort of on its toes and working.
Yeah, absolutely, Simon. I mean, Australia is a great example, and we see it through our client base, how they have this consistent, so it may be low growth rate in terms of the construction industry, you know, 2.5% per annum, but mm-hmm. it's steady and there's predictability, which means that construction companies can invest in people and, more importantly, contribute to investing in public-private partnerships. And as the Minister of Finance in his recent medium-term budget said, is that there's about a 440 billion rand funding gap for the priority projects that he's identified. And I think that one of the key ways to do that is unlock PPPs, because it crowds in private sector funding. And one of the extra benefits of PPPs is often the contractors are part of the consortium that's funding it. Mm-hmm. Which means that there's a much greater alignment of their project delivery to the whole project, i.e. they don't want to be over budget or over time because it impacts them as a shareholder and as a financier. So I think it enables much greater risk alignment in projects.
And it strengthens our industry. If we have sort of the boom and bust, which we've almost seen, the boom of the first decade of the century in terms of the World Cup and the Gautrain and all of that, and then we have the 10 lean years, we lose skills, we lose competence, do we not, potentially?
Absolutely, and we've seen this brain drain in the construction industry with young contracting managers, principals, those kind of skills leaving the country to other markets where there's been a really solid growth in construction. Australia, New Zealand particularly, the UK is also driving infrastructure strongly, and we're seeing a move of great skilled people to those markets, unfortunately.
We'll leave it there. That's Andrew Skada. That number, 13% globally employment in South Africa, only 8%. We're missing out huge. CEO at RIB CCS, appreciate the early morning.
We all have different investment needs. Some of us want to preserve our money for retirement and others to create wealth for the next generation. At Stanlib, we have a team of investment specialists that can help you achieve any investment goal. So whether your money is looking for more certainty, more return, or more impact through your investments, we have a solution for your investment needs, no matter the time horizon. Join us over the next few months as we provide insights into the solutions we offer to meet your money needs. To find out more, visit stanlib.com or speak to your financial advisor. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. License number 719.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
Chatting with Peter van der Ross, Portfolio Manager, Stanlib Multi-Strategy. Peter, appreciate your time today. Talking emerging markets, before we sort of delve into some of the mechanics around it, you've done some research on emerging markets versus developed markets performance and drivers of that performance. What can you share with us about that?
Yes, Simon, thank you. I guess the first complication is that emerging markets are a catch-all. It's not one thing, but in the interest of brevity, let's try and summarize. So the emerging markets as an asset class started to gain favor in the late 1980s. So in 1998, the MSCI introduced their emerging market index. Mm-hmm. And if one looks at since then, if one compares the performance of the main MSCI indices, emerging to developed markets, it looks like a big up-down pattern. So you've had two cycles, really, where emerging markets outperformed from the late 80s to about the mid-90s. And that was driven by, I suppose, this new promise of the structural growth outperformance.
Yeah.
A lot of capital flooded into emerging markets, and things started unraveling around about the mid-90s. We had a series of emerging market currency crises, eventually culminating in the Asian crisis, 97, 98. Then, of course, in the late 90s, we had the IT bubble in the U.S. And so that was the first big swing in the late 90s where developed markets started outperforming emerging markets, but it was mostly driven by the IT bubble. Then things changed again in the early 2000s, and then we had the China effect really kicking in. So from 2000, 2001 until 2000, actually 2010, I think we all know what happened in China and
yeah.
the massive infrastructure boom. And that really created a rising tide that lifted most emerging markets, because most emerging markets are involved in the commodity complex, somehow mostly commodity exporting nations. And then since then, again, you've had the rise of, I suppose, the Internet of Things, social media. So for the last 10 years, DM equity markets have outperformed EM, but again, mostly driven by the structural outperformance from US tech. So the NASDAQ, for example, over the last 10 years, has done something like 20% per annum. And so you've had this big sort of up-down pattern into point-to-point. EMs have not really outperformed DMs. They certainly don't look like the structural outperformer they looked likely to be, 30 years ago. Mm. They're also not a high beta or sort of geared play on some kind of global equity cycle, because they've been, actually the relative has been driven by, thematics. It's either
gotcha.
IT or infrastructure spend rather than GDP growth dynamics.
Yeah, so there has been, yeah, I take your point there. It's not the GDP. It's kind of what's the underlying story, which if we then bring it to the now, I mean, we've had a booming commodity cycle. Certainly it's helped SA, although that's cooling a bit in the PGM space. Of course, we've got the pandemic ongoing at the moment. I mean, looking into next year, and I appreciate it, a year is a short time in the investment world. Where would you be expecting emerging markets to perform?
So we still struggle to see why they would outperform next year. So remember, you know, China is, it's the second biggest economy in the world. Mm. It dominates the EM landscape. And so they have some specific problems there on their property sector. There's significant stress, we think, still to come in that sector. So a lot of bond maturities due in Q1 of next year. And then there's some Chinese politics at play next year as well. So Xi Jinping looking to secure an unprecedented third term.
Yeah.
So their key policy conference will be next October. He won't be wanting to rock the boat before then. And so for whatever reason, well, in fact, you know, a multitude of reasons, you know, their labor force is now shrinking. So the whole policy mix and set of policy objectives is changing rapidly in China. They're sitting on their hands, not really stimulating as they probably would have if their property sector was struggling as 10 years ago as it is now. But they're not stimulating. In the meantime, the Fed, US Fed, one would think is going to start responding to inflation. The dollar is looking strong again. That's typically not good for emerging markets. And so there are all sorts of reasons why we can't see emerging markets starting to outperform next year. The list goes on and on, but we would caveat that by saying at any point in time, there's a long list of reasons why markets shouldn't go up, and one does need to be alive. You've got to be alive to the price action, what the market's telling you. Right now, price action is not telling you that, I guess the difficult times for EMs are over.
Is there, I mean, we've been talking EMs sort of broadly as a concept, and you were touching a whole bunch there on China. Of course, South Africa is an emerging market. Is there an argument to be for certain perhaps regions or even countries within the EM space?
Well, I guess we go back to our initial caution in looking for structurally outperforming regions, because they typically, you know, for all the logic in the world, they often disappoint. So, I mean, the one interesting place is possibly India, but even that country has really struggled against the S&P in the last decade.
Yeah.
And many EMs are typically whipsawed by global dynamics first and foremost. And then secondly, there's risk of the odd own goal, right? So Turkey with their monetary policy.
Yeah.
Argentina with their, I guess, chronic series of debt defaults. So we don't tend to look for geographies that look like structural outperformers. Our inclination is more to try and package global ideas or themes like energy shortage or like ESG into baskets that cut across markets, and those could be developed or emerging markets. Mm. In other words, we'd rather try and divide up the world along thematic rather than geographic lines, because at least we can understand the thematic drivers better and then one's not beholden to politics or whatever in a particular region.
Yeah, and I take your point. And you say, as you say, I mean, they kind of get whipsawed by those global themes anyway, so find those thematic themes. We'll leave that there. That's Peter van der Ross, Portfolio Manager, Stanlib Multi-Strategy. Peter, appreciate the time. Chatting today to Peter there, he made some really great points, which I hadn't really realized the data. Question on our LinkedIn and Twitter polls today. Are you allocating part of your portfolio to emerging markets? I mean, obviously, we have in our Reg 28 because we are South Africa, we are an emerging market. But do you, with the rest, sort of go into EMs or perhaps your developed markets only? Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. That's the show for today. Our poll yesterday, we were asking if you had been buying the leisure stocks on Friday after the massive sell-off. Half of you said you'd have a look on Monday and see how it went. A quarter each said absolutely no ways, and a quarter of you said yes, you were. If you had, it was a good Monday for you. The question is, does it hold? There is, if nothing, just a lot of uncertainty out there. That was the key point that Nick Kuntz was making yesterday. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. We're live every weekday morning on the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. Podcast available just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nabuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their early morning contribution. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.